Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get the help that will transform their lives. My name's Jo.
I'm Jerry, and this is podcast 5B already from series 3. So we didn't have any podcasts in August, and we've just had one for September, which was the podcast about planning. That was 5A, so that was part of our series on the social work journey. And today it's 5B. We hope you're enjoying the podcasts, and you can, of course, let us know what you think by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes.
And today we're going to be talking about the good life, and I've got to say, I just really love this topic, and I love our B podcast. This is where we look at what we can learn from other disciplines, and it's so interesting, isn't it? We've been talking about the social work journey from first contact to the end of our involvement, and we've talked about what that journey's for, and we've just talked about planning. What is that for? And for me, it's like the point is to help people get closer to the life they want, and so it makes sense for us to talk about the good life. We're going to be drawing on philosophy, and we'll be thinking in particular about what the good life means globally.
And that's partly because in July, I was really lucky to go to the Global Conference on Social Work Education and Social Development, which was in Dublin. And there was lots of really useful thinking about how social work contributes to the good life in different parts of the world. And I'll also be talking later about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which is part of building the good life that we want across the globe. I'm going to start with a definition, basically, which is good, the definition of good. And there's so much in the dictionary definition of good. It's a very old word, and it kind of covers a lot of different concepts. So something that's desired or approved of, something that is of a high standard, something that possesses or shows moral virtue, something that is pleasurable or enjoyable or satisfying. So it kind of covers, the idea of a good life covers all the concepts of what you want, what other people think is good, what's morally good, and what might make you content or happy as well.
And I've got to say, Jerry, when I think about the good life, genuinely, the first thing that comes to my mind is that lovely British sitcom that I used to watch in Australia, starring Felicity Kendall and Richard Briers, you know, the one where the couple turned their back on the 9-to-5 and live off the land in their back garden.
Yeah, and they have a goat called Geraldine.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And, but, you know,
one of my famous namesakes.
Yeah. When I was a kid, it really struck a chord with me, I've got to say. I don't grow vegetables, but I've always kind of had the idea that the good life does include being closer to nature, producing what we need sustainably, treading lightly on the earth, cooperating with each other. And I was pleased to see when I started looking at, you know, the good life philosophically that I'm not alone, because utopian societies often strove for this ideal. And this utopia, this imagined community or society that possesses highly desirable or nearly perfect qualities for its citizens. And it's interesting, I had a look at Wiki, of course, God bless Wiki, and it said that it was a perfect place that has been designed so there is no problems. And I kind of thought, I don't know that my understanding of the good life is informed by a place where there's no problems, but it's certainly informed by a place where humans don't have to struggle for their daily survival, I guess.
And it's that idea of the difference between surviving and thriving, isn't it? That the good life takes us from just being alive to being alive in a positive, flourishing kind of way.
Yeah, and I love that word flourishing. I think that's just fantastic. And when I started, you know, thinking about this topic, I immediately went to Maslow's pyramid of needs, which I know we've talked about a few times. And it resonates to me because the bottom pyramid to me, the bottom bit that talks about need for food and shelter, I just think that every good life includes somewhere to live. I think every good life includes you feeling as if there is a stable, secure, affordable, well-maintained, adequate house that you can, you know, shape your life in. To me, that's step one of the good life. And it's interesting because in this country, in 2016, local authorities said that they had 59,260 households that were statutorily homeless. Mm. And so they'd agreed to house them. We have around 5,000 people counted on one night as being homeless, you know, sleeping rough, although charities talk about that figure being much higher. So as a social worker, there's work for us there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it links into a wider idea of social workers not just helping an individual in the situation that they're in, but changing their context and the kind of anti-poverty work that Basra's been doing, the austerity work that our association's been looking at in this country. The adoption inquiry that Basra did, which said, talked about the impact of poverty on families' opportunities to thrive and stay together, you know, that understanding of people can't achieve great outcomes, anything like as easily, if at all, without attention to those essential needs. Mm. Sometimes we're asking people to thrive without giving them the tools for survival, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's, you know, so for me, food is another one. You know, we've got 2,024 food banks in operation across the nation at the moment. You know, I think, I think a good life includes not having to be worried about where your next meal's going to come from or how to feed your family. These things matter. And, you know, warmth, fuel poverty is really a big thing in many households. In fact, the government has an annual fuel poverty statistic report, which says that 11% of households were in fuel poverty in 2017. So for me, a good life also includes being able to stay warm and cool enough, keep yourself comfortable, not be in distress. You know, maybe life is a good cup of tea and a biscuit when you want one, if health allows.
I think the interesting thing about Maslow's hierarchy is, I mean, it was a time specific bit of work, wasn't it, that Maslow did with in a particular culture with particular people. But that sense of hierarchy, I think, is really important for us to hang on to as social workers, that we really think about what the priorities are that people have, you know, making sure that they can survive and do well, and then thinking about, what is your priority? Where would you want to go next? Now that we've dealt with like these most essential issues, now that you're out of crisis, what's your next priority? What does the good life look like for you? And it will be different with different people, different characteristics and different cultures. But I think quite often people that we work with don't even have the opportunity to think about what that might be for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's that preoccupation with those basic fundamental needs that make them unavailable to actually pursue the other bits of life that add up to a good life.
Yeah, so the Greek philosophical tradition, which really influences how we think in the West about a good life, there's this word, which I think is pronounced eudaimonia.
I wasn't even going to try.
and the aim of kind of philosophy and thinking, really, what you were thinking about was how to attain that, how to attain this kind of idea of good, happiness, well-being. And it was linked to concepts of both doing well, thriving, and also living well, being a kind of a force for good, I suppose. Which is really interesting because it means that when we're thinking about well-being for people, we're not just thinking about doing okay, we're also thinking about what that person offers, how they fulfill their potential.
It's contribution, isn't it? And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Is contribution, feeling that you're contributing something to your society, to your friends, to people around you, is absolutely part of feeling like you're living a good life.
Yeah, and the other things that struck me when I was looking at this was the idea of the timeliness of the good life, when that, you know, the trade-off between pleasure now and maybe pain later, or, you know, some struggle and self-sacrifice now to attain something that's more important later on. And they also, it was also recognised in those philosophical traditions that it's not just about your individual agency, that bad luck and good luck, you know, fortune, fate influence your life. And I think that's really important for us to remember as well, because we do have a really strong individualistic belief in this, in our Western tradition, a lot of which we think comes from the kind of Greek and Roman tradition. But those traditions weren't about people necessarily about people being able to overcome everything. They were about how people responded to what was going on for them. But they did recognize that some people were more fortunate than others. And I think this kind of belief that if you want it enough, or if you work hard enough, or if you try enough, or you struggle enough, you'll have the good life is unhelpful in some regards, because some people's struggles and resource and social capital and support is less than others or more than others. Mm. And I think we do need to acknowledge that.
I think this is critical, Jerry. It's one of the things that I do worry about in the well-being work and the kind of all the work that's around about encouraging us to take hold of our life and to live a good life. And I particularly worry about it when it's linked with cancer, actually. Having lost my mother to cancer when she was 63 and another friend just recently, he was only in his early 50s. These were two people who really were motivated to live. Mm. And who did everything they could. And if you read some of the work around, you know, it's like put up the good fight and, you know, it's in your head and you need to this kind of message that it's individual willpower and effort that will make the difference. And I do think that we need to understand that sometimes, despite everything you do, the good life can be elusive.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think also the opposite thing can happen a little bit as well, that people can, you're talking about the kind of this idea of battling with cancer and, you know, that people, that the strong should survive kind of thing. Those are really unhelpful myths. There's an equally unhelpful myth the opposite way that can happen with dementia, that if you have dementia, it doesn't matter what you do, it's going to be terrible.
Yes.
And that's being patiently and courageously overcome by people living with dementia, showing that that's not the case. Yeah, so identifying what people can change and what we can help change around them and what makes people happy. Mm. These are really important social work tasks, aren't they? Tasks is the wrong word. Yeah, they're what we do.
They are. They're fundamental to our ability to contribute to people's good life. And I think that's the other thing that then can make us feel a bit excited, actually, because sometimes as social workers, we think of ourselves as people who stop abuse or neglect or problems, or we go in and make people safe. And we kind of think of ourselves almost as in this really kind of truncated, short, risk-focused role. But the fact is that we can contribute to people living a good life. And I think that that is tremendously powerful. You know, the bringing of joy and the enabling people to drop their preoccupation and become open to all sorts of possibilities is a very powerful and privileged role.
I think you were going to talk a bit about the happiness index, weren't you, which actually is quite useful in thinking about, okay, so if we are trying to support a good life, what sorts of things might we be looking at?
Yes, and it's really interesting. The happiness index was actually developed to look at another way of measuring how well countries are doing. And they talked about income, health, life expectancy, social support, freedom, trust, and generosity. And countries need to perform strongly across all the categories. Wealth alone does not provide happiness and well-being. And, you know, they talk about the happiness index. And the thing about this was that it originated from Bhutan. It was coined in 1979 during an interview at Bombay Airport, where the king of Bhutan said, "We do not believe in the gross national product. Gross national happiness is more important."
Yeah, and those variables are really helpful for us, aren't they? Because some of them we do think about a lot, I think. The income, health and life expectancy, and social support, we think about a lot in social care. I think increasingly we do think about freedom in terms of choice and control. And then trust and generosity. Trust, I suppose, those reciprocal relationships and good relationships. And generosity is linked a little bit to the growing idea and recognition of reciprocity, isn't it? Of people contributing as well as receiving. So, yeah, I think those concepts have always been in social work and social care. But it's really helpful to see them set out in that way as all being important and not being in a hierarchy.
That's right. And they're not. And they talk about the fact that they realize that whilst you may not have everything you want in all those areas, you may have enough to give you a good life. So they don't. Yes, that's right. They don't say one is more important than the other. They say, how much of this do you have across the whole scale? And is it enough to contribute to your good life? And this is the other thing, isn't it? It's not utopia. It's not a problem-free existence, because actually that doesn't exist. It's about our ability to overcome problems or to manage them or to even accept them if we can't do anything else with them, and to still go on. And I think the idea of generosity or contribution or reciprocity is something we should pay more attention to, because that's powerful for people. For people to feel that they're giving something is a really powerful and validating experience.
You've made me think as well about some of the cultural differences, which I'm not going to speak with any level of expertise, but I suppose one of the things that I'm conscious of growing up in this country, in the United Kingdom, is that there's quite a strong cultural tendency to think of winning as being success. So there's competitive kind of edge to the good life in some ways if you have more than the next person, whereas I think in other cultures there's more of a collective or communitarian approach. I mean, that it varies all over the country as well, so you know, it's going to be grossly oversimplified. I suppose it's just being attentive to the fact that different cultures have different ideas of the good life, and that we can learn so much from other people, and it will be individual, but it will also be it's very easy to impose a sense. And social work does have a very strong Western philosophical tradition to it, doesn't it? So it would be very easy for us to impose a good life, and that's almost by definition going to be not the good life for someone if it's imposed on them.
Well, a perfect example of that, of course, is in Australia, where social workers have to work in a culturally sensitive and appropriate way with Aboriginal and Islander cultures, and that we haven't always been successful at that, understatement of the year, and perhaps are still struggling now. I haven't been working in the field over there for a long time, but some of the things there is that, you know, the culture is much more about the community thriving. And so if one person has everything, there is really an expectation in that community that will be shared. It's the idea, you know, if you have more, build a longer table, not a higher fence.
Yeah.
And that has been really interesting for the Aboriginal culture, as, you know, certain people have been given money for land, but other people haven't, and then how they as a culture have then shared that out, and how they've understood their own traditional values in the context of white help, and how we've then had to relearn what it is that we think is helpful, and many of the things that we've done were not helpful.
Yeah. And I think in the UK, one of the strong examples of this is work with the traveller and gypsy communities and Romani communities, that there's just not been an understanding of what the good life means in those cultures, and this imposition of what we think are the important things, the things that matter.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're just not even curious enough about that as a question, are we? That's one of the things that as we're having this conversation, as often happens with me, sometimes, guys, if I go silent, it's because a penny's dropped for me as I'm talking. I've gone, oh, yeah. And I think for me, it's the realization we're not curious enough about what the good life looks like for people. Mm. We identify the problem and we want to fix that. But that's not always the same as the good life, is it?
No, and I think it's just this conversation has just made me realise how ignorant I am about what the good life might mean to other people. Mm. Yeah, I have a lot to learn. Actually, some things, though, I did learn at the Global Conference, which I was going to mention, because it was such a wonderful experience spending 4 days listening to people reporting on what they'd learned from research or from practice from all over the world. And I just wanted to throw in some kind of ideas from notes that I took at the time. So I'm still processing this, so it's quite raw. But in terms of the discussion about the good life and how social workers can promote it, so one of the things that came out was this concept of kind of making space for people, and social work as a third space. So between intersections, between person A and person B, between someone's kind of inner world and outer world, between services and an individual, that you create a space where people can understand and negotiate meaning.
I love that idea.
Yeah. And there was a really wonderful phrase from Erin Gray, who was talking about working with Indigenous partners, who was saying that non-Indigenous professionals need to learn to waste time in order to engage effectively. So they need to just make room, spend time, waste time, make space. And that it's there that a lot of the meaning kind of comes out, which is what we've been talking about, isn't it? That we don't know what matters to people, and we won't know if we don't sit down with them.
And if we go in with a really pressing agenda. Yeah. Sometimes our time frames and our own workloads and our own agendas just push that space away.
And then some of the other concepts came out from different talks about what had helped people, what made a difference to people's lives. And a lot of that was down to somebody being seen as a human, recognising someone's humanity and acting humanly towards them. So there was a talk about prisons, which was saying social workers in prisons humanise through there being ordinary relationships.
This is so critical, isn't it, that right at this moment when we really reflect on the failure of the prison in Birmingham, and where it seemed that a lot of the things that give people dignity and humanity and hope were not visible in that environment. If a person stays disconnected from society and the things that contribute to a meaningful life, it's really unlikely they'll see a reason to turn their life around. And so the good life must be an essential part of any strategy, actually, when you're developing prisons.
Yeah, and then the bringing people back to life, bringing their humanity out. So there was an example from an older person in a community support in Singapore, who said that they'd been involved in a creative project, and their phrase was that my life became filled with colours. Suddenly it was kind of like they'd gone from a very grey existence to a really bright one. And there was also this really wonderful picture from a dementia group of somebody talking about what would matter to them, what would be the good life for them, which just said, I miss my Scrabble, I need someone to take me.
Yeah,
quite sort of simple things, but really, really important. And lots of learning about how social work can support communities and can support global development, but only really through getting right in there and helping those communities develop themselves. So again, there was a message from Uganda, from someone who came to talk from there, saying social work needs to reclaim the ethic of community. So not that kind of imposition of individual or organisational help, but the learning and the energy that comes from a community.
And I think there's been a push, hasn't there, in England to try to embrace the community. There's been the work that's been done by Joe Cox, is that the Joe Cox's Foundation, family? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Joe Cox Foundation. That's all about trying to reconnect to the community. I mean, even David Cameron's Big Society idea was about trying to get energy back in the community. But it's how do we help people get to a stage where they want to invest in their communities? And yeah, I think that's a real role for social workers too. I like that idea of that third space.
And the difficult, one of the difficulties we have had historically, and we still do, is this this problem of expert imposition, which was discussed a lot in the global conference because of some of the really sort of sad stories of how social work has actually undermined the good life in other places by essentially people with privilege and power going in and imposing this is how you need to live. And one of the things that really helped me thinking about that was I went to a workshop on white privilege and how you might you can't necessarily overcome it, but you can certainly be unsettled by it and engage in activities to expose and kind of participate in overcoming it. And one of the things it said was that you've got to acknowledge where you've come from, that you're a visitor. That you've come to be on someone else's lands, which was part, mostly thinking about colonial power there, but actually there's a real sense of that for a social worker, that if you go into someone's house or you go into someone's space, someone's community, you've come from somewhere else and you acknowledge that and you acknowledge how you've come to be in their space and all the potential problems that might bring, so that then you can work with them whilst acknowledging that you're part of a problem.
Yeah. And I think that's, I like the quote you've got here about privileged persons must live as a problem. They can't avoid complicity and injustice while also fighting it. I think that's critical for us to remember. Many social work professionals are privileged people. There's no question. The fact that we have well-paid jobs and we have had higher education to get those jobs, you know, puts us in a position that that is privileged. But to, as you say, be really aware when you go into somebody else's life, you're on their land.
Yeah, and being unsettled by it.
Yeah.
And the one of the conclusions from one of the speeches about the troubled history that social work has was to say that we can realise the transformative power that social work has when we're confident enough to confront the troubled history of it,
yes,
and to learn from that and to live with that and develop from it. The thing I wanted to finish up with as well was the optimism of the Sustainable Development Goals, which are global goals that were set by the United Nations in 2015 and that were signed up to by the UN. So that's kind of all the countries, more or less, isn't it? And those goals are really about a good life for the planet. You know, what would global good life look like? And so they cover things like no poverty, zero hunger, quality education, gender equality, clean water for everyone, clean energy, work and economic growth. And then things like reducing inequalities, sustainable cities and communities, climate action, looking after our oceans, looking after the land, peace, justice, partnerships around the world. So they're really, in one sense, they're really aspirational. In another sense, they're really simple.
Yes.
And they are really about the range of things that we've talked about, from the very kind of essential to people not being hungry through to the care for the kind of beauty of the world and care for justice.
They're very holistic, aren't they, Joe? Because they're acknowledging that actually we are an animal on this planet, and that part of what we need to do is look after ourselves, but also look after the planet and look after the other things that are living on this planet. And I think that's right. It's once again, it's that idea of being part of a reciprocal system where we actually do things for each other. And I do think that makes a lot of sense for social workers to be thinking about.
Yeah, and the International Federation of Social Work, which for the UK, the British Association belongs to, it's kind of global federation of all these social work associations, has a global agenda, which was set in 2012, which has got four sort of areas of work. There's social and economic equality, dignity of, and worth of people's, environmental sustainability, and recognition of the importance of human relationships. And those are the themes that World Social Work Day has followed. So we've had three of those themes, and there's one in March next year, which is the one about the importance of human relationships. And depending on how I'm feeling, some days I think these are such big areas, or these sustainable development goals are so overarching that we can't possibly attain them, and how difficult. And then other days, more of the days, I think, isn't it wonderful to be part of a profession and a global profession, global movement that is focused on the things that really matter, that is actually contributing to the good life. So we contribute in our day-to-day work and our endeavours locally, but each social worker who's doing that around the world is contributing to these global goals. And when we join together in an association, or we join together in a European movement, or in the social work in the Commonwealth area, or you know, whatever associations or partnerships we find social workers going off to do international development work, or getting to know people in other countries, all of those things join up these endeavours to this kind of global work for the good life. And I think that's really, yeah, that's really optimistic.
Absolutely. And it makes sense to me that we lift our eyes out of the mire that we sometimes find ourselves in to look at the stars, basically. I mean, I think that we need to be mindful of ourselves as part of the bigger picture. And, you know, maybe we should end with the words of Dr. Seuss and the Lorax, one of my favourite characters, where he says, you know, unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.